TED Audio Collective.
This TED Talk features global citizen Wanice Kabbaj, recorded live at TED at UPS 2018.
Welcome to the Canva guided meditation for stress at work. Impending deadline? Generate Canva presentations in seconds.
So fast.
Brainstorm got too big? Summarize with AI in a click. Writer's block? Release with Canva Magic Write.
Magical.
Stress less and save time at canva.com. Designed for work.
Apple Card is the perfect cash back rewards card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase, every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City Branch, subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
So 2 weeks ago, I searched the word nationalist on Twitter. The results were quite colorful, with expressions like emboldened racist moron, white supremacist idiot, fascist sock puppets, Orwellian, Hitlerian, terrifying. I then searched the word globalist and got things like socialist sellout, disgusting corporate propaganda, elitist financial overlords, rootless cosmopolitan rats. Even by social media standards, the words are cruel and disgusting, but they reflect the intensity of one of the most fundamental questions of our times. Nationalism or globalism? What is the best path forward? This question impacts everything we care about: our cultural identity, our prosperity, our political systems, everything, the health of our planet, everything. So on the one hand, we have nationalism. Collins defines it as a devotion to one's nation, but also a doctrine that puts national interests above international considerations. For nationalists, our modern societies are built on national grounds. We share a land, a history, a culture, and we defend each other. In a big and chaotic world, they see nationalism as the only sensible way to maintain social stability. But alarmed globalists warn us. Self-centered nationalism can easily turn ugly. We've seen it with 20th century fascisms. Bloody wars, millions of deaths, immeasurable destructions. On the other hand, we have globalism. The Oxford Living Dictionary defines it as the operation or planning of economic and foreign policy on a global basis. For nationalists, globalism is rapidly deconstructing what our ancestors took decades to build. It's like spitting on our soldiers' tombs. It's eroding our national solidarities and opening the doors to foreign invasions. But globalists make the case that reinforcing our global governance is the only way to tackle big supranational problems like nuclear proliferation, the global refugee crisis, climate change, or terrorism, or even the consequences of superhuman AI. So we are at the crossroads, and we are asked to choose nationalism or globalism. Having lived in four continents, I've always been interested in this question. But it took a whole new level when I saw this happening: the biggest surge in nationalist votes in Western democracies since World War II. All of a sudden, this isn't theory anymore. I mean, these political movements have built their success with ideas that could mean down the road losing my French citizenship because I'm North African, or not being able to come back home to the US because I come from a Muslim-majority country. You know, when you live in a democracy, you live with this idea that your government will always protect you as long as you abide by the laws. With the rise of national populism, despite being the best citizen I can, I now have to live with the idea that my government can hurt me for reasons I cannot control. It's very unsettling. But it forced me to rethink this question and try to think deeper. And the more I thought about it, the more I started questioning the question: Why would we have to choose between nationalism and globalism, between loving our country and caring for the world? There's no reason for that. We don't have to choose between family and country, or region, or religion and country. We already have multiple identities, and we live with them very well. Why would we have to choose between country and world? What if instead of accepting this absurd choice, we took it on ourselves to fight this dangerous binary thinking? So for all the globalists in the audience, I want to ask, when I say the word nationalist, what image comes to your mind? Something like this? Believe me, I think of that too. But I'd like you to remember that for most people, nationalism feels more like this, or maybe like that. You know, it's that thing inside you when you accidentally watch an obscure Olympic sport on TV. Wait, and the mere sight of an unknown athlete wearing your national colors gets you all excited. You know, your heartbeat goes up, your stress level goes up, and you're standing in front of that TV and screaming with passion for that athlete to win. That's nationalism. It's people happy to be together, happy to belong to a large national community. Why would it be wrong? You know, globalists, you may think of nationalism as an old 19th century idea that is destined to fade. But I'm sorry to tell you that the facts are not on your side. When the World Value Survey asked more than 89,000 people across 60 countries how proud they felt about their country, 88.5% said very proud or quite proud. 88.5%. Nationalism is not going away anytime soon. It's a powerful feeling that, according to another study, is a strong predictor of individual happiness. It's crazy, but your happiness is more correlated with national satisfaction than with things you would expect, like household income, or your job satisfaction, or your health satisfaction. So if nationalism makes people happy, why would anybody take it away from them? Fellow globalists, if you are like me, you may be attached to globalization for humanistic reasons, and you may take great joy in some of its accomplishments since 1945. After all, major regions of the world have been exceptionally peaceful. Extreme poverty rates around the globe are trending down. And more than 2 billion people, most notably in Asia, saw spectacular improvements in their standards of living. But studies also show that globalization has a dark side. And left on the side of the road, hundreds of millions of people on Western middle classes with anemic income growth for more than 2 decades, possibly 3 decades, according to some studies. We cannot ignore this elephant in our room. If anything, our collective energy would be better used finding ways to fix this aspect of globalization instead of fighting this polarizing battle against nationalism. So now, the nationalist in the audience, I have some crusty non-binary nuggets for you. When I say the word globalist, what comes to your mind? Out-of-touch 1% plutocrats? Or maybe the heartless, greedy Wall Street type, right? Or maybe people like me, with multiple origins, living in a big cosmopolitan metropolis. Well, you remember that World Value Survey that I mentioned earlier? It showed another fascinating finding. 71% of the world population agreed with the statement, "I'm a citizen of the world." Do you know what it means? Most of us are simultaneously proud of our country and citizens of the world. And it gets even better. The citizens of the world in the survey show a higher level of national pride than the ones that rejected that label. So once and for all, being a globalist doesn't mean betraying your country. It just means that you have enough social empathy and you project some of it outside your national borders. Now, I know that when I dig into my own nationalist feelings, one of my anxieties versus the globalized world is national identity. How are we going to preserve what makes us special, what makes us different, what brings us together? And as I started thinking about it, I realized something really strange, which is that a lot of the key ingredients of our national identities actually come from outside our national borders. Like, think of the letters that we use every day. I don't know if you realize, but the Latin alphabet that we use has its origins thousands of years ago near the Nile River. It all started with a cow, just like this, that was captured by a scribe into an elegant hieroglyph. That hieroglyph was transcribed by a Semite in the Sinai into the letter Aleph. Aleph traveled with Phoenicians and reached the European shores in Greece, where it became Alpha, the mother of our letter A. So that's how an Egyptian cow became our letter A. And same thing with the Egyptian house that became Bet, Beta, and B, and the Egyptian fish that became Dalet, Delta, and D. Our most fundamental texts are full of Egyptian cows, houses, and fish. And there are so many other examples, like take the United Kingdom and its monarchy. Queen Elizabeth II, German ancestry. The mottos on the royal coat of arms, all written in French, not a single word of English. Take France and its, you know, and its iconic Eiffel Tower. The inspiration, the United States of America. And I don't mean Las Vegas, I mean 19th century New York. This was the tallest building in New York in the mid-19th century. Does it remind you of something? And you may think of China as a self-contained civilization protected behind its Great Wall. But think twice. The Chinese official ideology, Marxism, made in Germany. One of China's biggest religion, Buddhism, imported from India. India's favorite pastime, cricket. I really love this quote from Ashish Nandi, who said, "Cricket is an Indian game accidentally discovered by the British." So, you know, these are good reminders that a lot of what we love in our national traditions actually come from previous waves of globalization. And beyond individual symbols, there are whole national traditions that could not have existed without globalization. And the example that comes to my mind is a world-beloved national tradition, Italian cuisine. My friends, if you ever have a chance to go to a super authentic Italian restaurant that only serves ancient Roman recipes, my advice for you is don't go. You'd get very, very disappointed. No spaghetti, no pasta. That really started in Sicily in the 8th century when it was under Arabian rule. No perfect espresso, no creamy cappuccino that came from Abyssinia via Yemen in the 17th century. And of course, no perfect pizza Napoletana. How would you make it without the tomatoes of the New World? No, instead, you would be served probably a lot of porridge, some vegetable, mostly cabbage, some cheese, and maybe, if you're lucky, the absolute delicacy of that time. Perfectly cooked, fattened dormice. Thankfully, it was not a closed tradition preserved by fanatic watchdogs. No, it was an open process nourished by explorers, traders, street sellers, and innovative home cooks. And in many ways, globalization is a chance for our national traditions to be questioned, regenerated, reinterpreted, to attract new converts, to stay vibrant and relevant over time. So just remember this. Most of us nationalists in the world are globalists, and most of us globalists in the world are nationalists. A lot of what we like in our national traditions come from outside our national borders. And the reason we venture outside our national borders is to discover these other national traditions. So the real question should not be to choose between nationalism and globalism. The real question is, how can we do both better? It's a complex question for a complex world that calls for creative, non-binary solutions. What are you waiting for? Thank you.
For more TED Talks, go to TED.com.